This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, shot down. Was the crash of a Ukrainian passenger jet a terrible mistake? And as firefighters again brace for dangerous conditions, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison is my guest. We'll also meet the soldiers using their skills on the bushfire frontline.
In the military, you train all the time. You train for something that, when it comes to warfighting, that you hope you never have to do. This is a great use of training because it's helping the local community.
Canada's Prime Minister says intelligence shows that an Iranian missile was responsible for shooting down a Ukrainian passenger jet over Tehran. All 176 passengers on board were killed, including 63 Canadians. Our North America correspondent is David Lipson. David, what's the Canadian Prime Minister had to say?
Well, Kim, Justin Trudeau has put some serious meat on the bones as to a theory that's been growing in stature, if you like, in the last hours and days. That is that it was Iran that brought down this passenger plane carrying 176 people on board soon after takeoff from Tehran. Here's what he had to say.
We have intelligence from multiple sources, including our allies and our own intelligence. The evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile. This may well have been unintentional. This new information reinforces the need for a thorough investigation into this matter.
That's the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. David, the US President Donald Trump was floating a very similar theory not so long ago.
Yeah, he was indeed, Kim. He wasn't nearly as specific, but he was certainly asked about media reports here in the United States that intelligence sources had suspected with a high degree of certainty that indeed that plane was shot down accidentally by Iran. Here's what the president had to say. He didn't think, by the way, that it was mechanical failures. Have a listen.
Somebody could have made a mistake on the other side. Could have made a mistake. It was flying. It was flying in not our system. No, it has nothing to do with us. It was flying in a pretty rough neighborhood, and somebody could have made a mistake. Some people say it was mechanical. I personally don't think that's even a question. Personally.
David, in the meantime, the president has also given a bit more detail about the so-called imminent attack that was in the works that led him to order the death of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani.
That's right. A small amount more detail. Up until now, we've just been hearing those words repeated, that the attack was imminent. We heard the Secretary of State say that Iran was planning something big through Qasem Soleimani, but never really any discussion of exactly what target was expected to be hit by the Americans. Today, Donald Trump seemed to let slip that he believed it was the US embassy that was indeed in Qasem Soleimani's sights.
We caught a total monster and we took him out. And that should have happened a long time ago. We did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy.
That's the US President Donald Trump, and before him, our North America correspondent David Lipson. Well, the Prime Minister is Scott Morrison, and he joins me on the line now. Prime Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Kim.
As we've just heard, Canadian intelligence suggests an Iranian missile brought down the Ukrainian passenger jet. Does Australia have similar intelligence?
Yes, we do, but it does not suggest that this was intentional. That's why it's very important that there's full cooperation with any inquiry that is going on in relation to the tragic downing of that Ukrainian flight. And 63 Canadians who are affected. I spoke to Prime Minister Trudeau about this yesterday. We're offering what support we can through our embassy in Tehran. I understand that the Italian embassy is also providing a lot of support to the Canadians in that area as well.
You talk about support. Given Australia's experience with the MH17 investigation, will we offer to help with the investigation in that way?
Well, at this stage, I think we'll let those countries that are directly involved here take carriage of that. I mean, I've said to Prime Minister Trudeau, if there's anything we can do to assist, then of course we will. They have lost a large number of citizens in this terrible tragedy, and obviously it's important for the sake of their families that this matter is addressed fully, and we would expect that to occur, and we'd be seeking everyone to be cooperating with that.
Turning to the bushfire emergency, are you shocked by the magnitude of this disaster? And as a nation, do we need to brace ourselves for many more years of this?
Well, certainly I am in terms of the shock, and I think all Australians are. I mean, the scale of what we've been seeing is, I've been relaying to international leaders as they've called in and expressing their concern and sympathies to all Australians, of just taking them through what the scale of this has been. They've been very interested to know. And it's been the length of the season, Kim, but also the fact that there's been the lack of dousing rains that has enabled to get relief from a lot of these very large fire complexes, which continue to expand. And today they threaten again in South Australia, there on Kangaroo Island, as well, of course, in New South Wales and Victoria, where there are severe to extreme fire forecasts. And so I encourage everybody to get yourself to a place of safety, listen to instructions, stay together and support each other, as you've been doing so well over so many months now, and particularly the last few weeks.
You've copped a lot of criticism for your initial response to this crisis. Have you taken a bit of time to reflect on your leadership and your judgment?
Well, we've been just very focused on delivering the response, Kim. I mean, copping flak comes with the job, whether it's, however it comes. And that's just part of what the job is as Prime Minister. But the other and most important part is getting the response in. This is the single largest response to a national bushfire crisis that the country has ever seen. Up to 3,000 reserves has been called out. The National Bushfire Recovery Agency is established within days following that, $2 billion to support in initial and additional funds yesterday, rolling out money, which I understand hit the New South Wales bank accounts yesterday, so they can move that quickly into the councils, I would hope, today, which enables them to immediately respond. Health responses I'll be announcing very soon based on the decisions we made yesterday at National Security Committee. Ministers are bringing forward proposals right across the spectrum of all of their operations. Andrew Colvin is not only heading up the recovery agency, but chairing all department secretaries as part of a Commonwealth effort to bring forward the initiatives, whether it's in agriculture, tourism, environmental restoration, immediate support and needs. The Defence Force, of course, each and every day out there providing support that's needed in community.
You're considering some sort of national inquiry. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner, Shane Fitzsimmons, points out that there've been reviews after every season. Would you seek the advice of fire chiefs before deciding on whether to press ahead?
Well, that's exactly what I have been saying. All I've said in response to questions when this has been put to me is that I'd be working with states and territories to find the most effective way to undertake a review of what has occurred, what the contributing factors were, what the response has been, how we can better prepare for the future. That's simply all I've said. People have suggested royal commissions. I mean, I don't rule those sorts of things out.
Any states on board with that idea of a royal commission?
Well, we haven't even commenced any discussions on that at all, and now is not the time for that. Now is the time for fighting fires and getting response in place. All I've said, and I have discussed with some premiers, that at some point we're going to have to come to agreement on how we can do some of that together. And I think that's the appropriate way to do it. But I'm certainly not going to do that in isolation to the states and territories. It's my intention to work very closely with them about how we best organise that. But right now, Shane Fitzsimmons, as he and I both know, we want him focused on fighting fires, not what reviews should be and shouldn't be. And that's not a position or an issue that's being progressed at this stage.
On climate change, who's telling you that the target of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% by 2030 is still good enough?
Well, this is the commitment the government has had, outstanding for many years now, and we've had that.
But doesn't the scale of this disaster require some sort of recalibration?
Well, based on that, that would reduce the fire risk in Australia.
That's what I'm asking you. You don't think that the scale of this disaster requires a policy to be re-examined?
What it requires for us to do is to meet and beat our commitments, and that's what I've said we're going to do, Kim. The suggestion that Australia either, increasing its emissions reduction targets would somehow not have resulted in these fires, I think is an absurd proposition. Let's just remind ourselves.
I'm asking about whether anything further needs to be done, though.
Kim, if I could just finish my answer. What I'm saying is 2020, this is when these fires are occurring. In 2020, Australia is beating its emissions targets under the Kyoto Protocol by 411 million tonnes. Now, there are very few countries that can make that claim. In fact, there are many countries that won't even meet their Kyoto targets. So if we're talking about countries that are meeting and carrying their burden right now, when these fires are burning right now, then Australia has been meeting and beating its targets right now.
I understand that, Prime Minister.
And beat our 2030 targets. I understand that, Prime Minister. Progressed to meet those 2030 targets.
And I'm asking about whether or not some revision of a target needs to be made. Because are you saying that Australia is doing all it can and more, you're saying, to limit greenhouse gas emissions? But is there a possibility that we need to do more?
Well, when I talk about beating our targets, Kim, then obviously that would be the result of us being able to achieve more than what we've set out. I mean, that's what meeting and beating targets means. But what we'll also do, Kim, is make sure that our policies are balanced and sensible. Our policies don't pursue reckless job-destroying and economy-destroying targets, which won't reduce bushfire risk, but will take people's jobs. So we'll keep a balanced view on this, and we'll keep an applied view on this, a practical view. 50 million tonnes of emissions less on average every year under our government compared to the previous government. That's what we're achieving, Kim.
You've mentioned that the National Inquiry may look at everything, including climate change. So are you leaving the door open if that National Inquiry comes back and says some sort of adjustment needs to be made, some sort of recalibration, that the government would be open to taking the advice of any inquiry?
Well, I've simply said that any inquiry would need to look at the full breadth of factors that are relevant. And of course, we'd review any recommendations that came from that. And Kim, but the suggestion that somehow Australia's emissions reductions are directly linked to fire events in Australia, that's just not true.
If we look beyond greenhouse gas emissions and we look at climate adaptation, for example, would you, for example, guarantee funding for the bushfire and natural hazards CRC beyond 2021, which is when it's due to run
this
out?
Which is some time away from now, and that would have been addressed in the normal course of the budget. And these are the obvious things. I mean, these things are not under threat, Kim, and people running around suggesting that they are, I think, is not very helpful at times like this.
You don't think that the public opinion has changed because of this terrible summer?
I think the public opinion on this issue has been heightened across a whole range of factors, and climate is one, but, I mean, there are a range of other things. I mean, the drought, which is not and unrelated to the issues we're talking about, but hazard reduction and how we manage that in the future, because hazard reduction has proved to be very difficult in recent times because of the drought. And so with longer fire seasons, which, you know, there's, you know, a view that those longer fire seasons will be with us, then we have to look at ways that we can reduce hazard in a way where there are more drier conditions. Mm-hmm. Now, that goes to where people build houses. That goes to how people can clear land. It goes to how we manage native vegetation. And there have been many controversial debates about that and a lot of pushback on some of those policies as well. So, Kim, I'm up to discuss all of those things, and there's no hesitancy or pushback from the government to address any of those things. But I think we have to address them calmly and rationally and in proper context and perspective, and it's important that we maintain that balanced approach.
All right.
But right now, there's fires and they need to be addressed. Right now, there are people at risk who need support, and that's where my full effort and full attention is focused.
Okay, Prime Minister, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks a lot, Kim.
That is the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. And as he mentioned, there are fires still burning in large parts of Australia. Victoria and New South Wales are once again bracing for a return to dangerous bushfire conditions, while firefighters on South Australia's Kangaroo Island are still battling out-of-control blazes. In all of these states, firefighters are being helped by Defence Force personnel. And our reporter, David Sparks, met some of them in East Gippsland.
The bushfires in East Gippsland have turned thousands of roadside trees into potentially deadly traffic hazards, and they have to be removed. Captain Shannon Garrett is on the road today. He's one of the defence personnel organising this massive task.
Today I have a troop out on the ground in support of local civilian contractors, doing what our primary task is since we arrived, so opening up the roads just so emergency services, local populace can get through to their homes and do so safely.
In some cases, personnel are doing the job themselves. In others, they're travelling with and supporting professional arborists. One of those arborists is Kyle Batt.
It's a giant task ahead of us, mate, yeah. To be honest, it's huge. There's a lot of devastation around the area, yeah.
Since the fires began, vital roads have been blocked by fallen trees, which are gradually being removed. But removing damaged trees still standing by the road is taking up much more time.
The felling of burnt trees is a complex and advanced fell, so quite dangerous task. So that'll take as long as it takes.
For areas where the trees are even bigger, larger machinery is needed. Lieutenant John Alakoz is in charge of that side of the operation.
The equipment we've got backhoes, front-end loaders, graders and skid steer loaders. So we've got drivers, operators to do that internally within our call sign.
Battlefield capabilities have been used in several ways during these bushfires. On Saturday, Chinook helicopters were used to airlift residents from the Omeo football ground while intense fires and smoke swirled around them. And yesterday, military helicopters were able to deliver 400 kilogram hay bales to isolated communities. Major Jamie Twidale says it's an example of the expertise that very few organisations have.
Lifting up bales of hay under a helicopter sounds really easy, but it's a highly technical activity and you need exactly the right kit.
Most of the personnel here are reservists. They've left their day jobs and families to take part.
In the military, you train all the time. And you train for something that when it comes to warfighting that you hope you never have to do. This is a great use of training because it's helping the local community. So the team is loving it. They're loving getting out and helping the community and using the skills that they have.
That's Major Jamie Twidale ending that report from David Sparks. So many towns and cities have been cloaked in bushfire smoke this summer. At times, Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra have all recorded the worst air quality in the world. But experts say it might be years before we know the long-term health effects. To discuss this, I spoke earlier to the Acting Chief Medical Officer of Australia, Professor Paul Kelly. Professor Kelly, are the bushfires posing a public health emergency?
Well, certainly there are public health risks in relation to bushfires. Firstly, of course, the risk to life and the terrible news of people who have lost their lives over the last weeks and months is a terrible tragedy. The other risks, of course, and the ones that are very prominent at the moment in many parts of Australia is from bushfire smoke. And so that can indeed exacerbate people's condition, underlying conditions, or indeed people without underlying respiratory or lung or heart disease can also have symptoms.
Is there a lot of research about the long-term impacts of prolonged exposure?
Well, it's interesting. There is, of course, a lot of research that has been done in relation to air pollution in highly polluted cities in North America, in Europe, more recently in Asia. These are slightly different to the conditions we're having at the moment because in those places the pollution remains and can increase over time. We've seen those sort of events in Delhi, for example, over the last few years where bushfire smoke has increased the underlying air pollution in that city. That's not the case in many parts of Australia where very good air quality is the norm. So these are unusual conditions. How much we can take the research that's been done in those other places into our own setting remains to be seen.
So would your office or the Federal Health Department actively undertake or commission research into the long-term health impacts from bushfires themselves?
I'm certainly in discussions with Minister Hunt about exactly that. I think what we do know at the moment is, and this is very good news, is for those places where the return to normal, very good air quality is likely to be the case, that the effects of bushfire smoke on health are reversible in those situations.
The federal government has supplied almost 2 million P2 masks to bushfire-affected communities. Is there some sort of stockpile that you'll now have to maintain, just like crucial medicines?
So we do have a stockpile of masks. That's particularly for the threat of pandemic influenza, SARS and so forth that we keep an eye on with our international links. So that's why we have the stockpile and we certainly need to maintain that because those things, we never know when that's going to happen. But yes, we have made the decision to release stock from that stockpile. Actually, it's up to almost 3 million masks today. We'll be giving an update on that later today. And we've been responding responding to requests from jurisdictions who have that need, as well as particular other people that are unable to avoid the poor air quality. So, for example, we've released almost 20,000 masks to Australia Post, some to the Federal Police, others including to the Defence Forces, who are, of course, out there on the front line.
People in these bushfire-ravaged areas have experienced a lot of trauma. Would you recommend to the government that the cap be lifted on the number of mental health consultations allowed under Medicare, for example?
Well, certainly that is a very important point you make there, Kim. And the mental health effects of the trauma that people are having, their changes in their lives, loss of their normal life, of their houses, of livestock, even of the environment around them, which we all so much love, cannot be underestimated. The Prime Minister the other day made an announcement about the recovery fund, and within that there will be a mental health package, and Minister Hunt will be making an announcement about that in coming days.
Professor Paul Kelly is the Acting Chief Medical Officer of Australia. Well, while fires and drought continue unabated in the southeast of the country, there's been some good weather news for communities in the west. The first cyclone of the season has brought some much-needed relief to pastoralists in Western Australia, many of whom have had some of their lowest rainfall on record in the past 12 months. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
This sound has allowed pastoralists to breathe a sigh of relief.
There's no more of a magic feel than a great start to the year, and just having that rain on the ground, there's just nothing better really, if you ask me.
Annabelle Coppin runs Yarri Station, about 90 kilometres north of Marble Bar in Western Australia's Pilbara. While she insists things haven't been as tough for her as they have been for others, she's had about half of her average rainfall in the past 12 months. And the first big rains of the wet season are very welcome.
There's already green shoots now. You know, it's not just the grass, it's all of the other different little shrubs come alive, and all the animals out there, not just cattle, I'm talking about birds and lizards and all sorts of animals. Everyone's just relieved, like I say. She's a magic thing, the old rain, isn't it?
Communities have been put on alert as ex-tropical cyclone Blake travels through central parts of Western Australia, bringing with it damaging winds and heavy rains. Several roads across the Kimberley and Pilbara regions have been closed due to flooding. But with 2019 the warmest and second driest on record for WA, many parts of the state are suffering under drought conditions, which is why so many are celebrating any rainfall, big or small.
Oh, well, that's an absolute... It's hard to explain. It's just so good to see. It really, really is.
Pastoralist Patrick Hill is the Shire President of Laverton, about 1,000 kilometres northeast of Perth. He'd only received 6 millimetres of rain when he spoke to the WA Country Hour on Thursday, but even that was enough to put a smile on his face.
It's an absolute godsend here this morning. I'll tell you what, I've really put laying water around. It's the first time I've seen water laying around like this for a year or two.
And there's hope the storm might go some way to easing bushfires in the south of the state, which have forced the closure of the Eyre Highway for 11 days. The highway is the only sealed road linking WA and South Australia, and the closure has left travellers and truck drivers stranded on both sides of the border. It's expected to reopen in the next couple of days once conditions are safe.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. In the UK, there are growing questions over the bombshell announcement by Prince Harry and his wife Meghan that they'll be stepping aside from key royal duties. The royal family was blindsided by the news, with not even the Queen being told beforehand. Now there's growing disquiet over how they can enjoy the independence they've announced while keeping their royal titles. From London, our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
Across the UK, this was the only news of the day.
All right. Very well, Buckingham Palace?
Yeah, no problem.
Fantastic, thank you.
And who better to ask about the public response than a black cab driver?
A lot of people are gutted because they are. He is part of it. He's the king's son, like, or the future king's son, and he didn't even tell the Queen, I don't think.
Gutted, but also sceptical that the couple want independence, but also the taxpayer funds according to driver Alfie Scales.
They got to cut all tyres as well. That means the taxpayer can't pay for them as well. They've got to be proper independent.
So they can't have sort of one foot in, one foot out?
Not like have the Queen's Guards, like the police protection. That's it. If you leave, that's it, you leave.
Not even the Queen was told before their announcement. Now there are far more questions than answers about how they can have their independence but keep their royal titles.
The Queen is apparently shocked and Prince Charles and Prince William are furious.
Paul Connew is the former editor of the Sunday Mirror.
This is a sort of have your cake and eat it approach where they want to carry on with which royal duties suit them and which don't.
People are talking about the money. How will they earn the money? Will the British public accept that, one foot in, one foot out?
If they want to be truly independent, then they should really lobby the Queen to remove their royal title. I don't see that happening.
Chris Shipp, the ITV royal editor, describes it as a messy affair.
I mean, the palace don't know what's going on. Are they going to stay living in Frogmore Cottage? Are they still going to have their taxpayer-funded protection officers? How do they live half the year in Canada or North America and the other half the year in the UK?
The couple, scathing of the British press, moved swiftly to isolate the tabloids, revealing on their website they'll now favour grassroots media organisations and attacked the credibility of royal correspondents. And they'll no longer be part of the Royal Press Rota that allows media groups to share coverage of royal events. Paul Connew again.
They don't seem to like to have any sort of criticism. They seem to think the media should be dealing with them on their terms only.
Near Buckingham Palace, some American tourists were pleased with the shift.
I don't know much about them, but I think it's very exciting to have an American join the royal family. Obviously, that's exciting for us Americans.
Yeah, do you think they'll be welcomed in America? How will Americans
maybe more welcome than here.
More yeah. Welcome.
Madame Tussauds announced waxworks of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex have been removed from the royal family display. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
As millions of Taiwanese voters head to the polls this weekend, a Chinese defector to Australia is at the heart of last-minute interference claims. Partisan allegations are flying back and forth about Wang Licheng, a self-described intelligence operative who previously claimed to have meddled in Taiwan's democracy. From Taipei, here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
Taiwan's presidential candidates are making their final push. With less than 48 hours to go, the heavy underdog, a theatrical mayor named Han Guoyu, is rallying the faithful in Taipei. A key figure from his party, Sean Lien, says Mr. Han can revive the economy and win China's trust.
Whether China is going to launch military operation against Taiwan next year or tomorrow, that's a big question mark.
Taiwanese campaigns are big on uniforms, dramatic music and very loud speeches. In the nearby city of Taoyuan, fans of the incumbent president Tsai Ing-wen have much more reason for confidence. She's ahead in the polls and spent her final rallies promising to safeguard the island's democracy and independence from the Chinese Communist Party. It's a theme her foreign minister Joseph Wu keeps repeating. He claims China is behind a mass disinformation campaign, aiming to sway voters to ditch President Tsai and elect her much more Beijing-friendly opponent.
The fake news situation seems to be quite serious, and many people attribute it to a significant part of China's interference in our election.
Taiwan's opposition accuses Tsai Ing-wen's government of spreading fake news. Analysts say disinformation is a massive problem for this year's poll. Summer Chen runs a non-partisan fact-checking centre.
When rumours are spread around, they make it harder for society to discuss political topics rationally. People get angry and emotional. It widens the divide between the two major parties and in society.
In the final days of the campaign, an Australian twist. A Chinese defector to Australia named Wang Licheng has re-emerged. He last year claimed he'd run fake news campaigns in Taiwan for a pro-China businessman. Nine newspapers report he's now been offered money by pro-Beijing interests to retract his earlier claims. But a local politician accused of offering the inducement has hit back, saying Mr. Wang was offered money by President Tsai's party to make false statements. If it sounds confusing, it is. And in an election campaign hampered by false claims and dodgy information, few people here know what to believe. This is Bill Birtles in Taipei, reporting for AM.
And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.